Do you want to say something about your move to Ashland Chemical in 77?
Well, since the focus is on the Perkin metal and that centers around acrylonitrile and its derivatives, why we probably should make that a bit on the briefer side.
Sure.
But that was, I guess, a mid-career change, which I was ready for. It certainly offered a combination of management and science opportunities that was not immediately open at Ohio. And I took it for both career and economic reasons. It was a nice jump in remuneration and for rank as well. But the gentleman who persuaded me to come to Ashland, one of my classmates at Purdue, Jim Lewis, now resting, bless his heart, was another unique kind of industrial chemical administrator, himself a PhD physical chemist, and one of his requirements was that the person he hired for this position of manager venture research and development, which translates micro corporate, was that he be both a scientist and a manager, and that he was expected to remain a scientist as well as a manager, so it had all the fittings that I wanted. And so it was a pretty much of a romance from the start. It was not without its problems, as any job is. But largely working through other people, and I've always in my life tried to be careful not to foist my name on somebody's publication or patent, and I think I can claim that I've never done that. It's only there when it belongs, and there's probably a lot of times when it doesn't belong that it should have been there. But they wanted to develop a presence in the petrochemical industry, building on petrochemical monomers, just as Ohio did. And I think they were hoping for another acrylonitrile, hoping lightning would strike twice. And they had some very nice polymer work on which a lot of their chemical company sales were based. And so we developed some very nice products there, among other things. And it's in my resume that you'll see is the process for methyl methacrylate based on propylene and CO, which was pilot planted and in the economic crisis of the early 80s, Ashland simply did not have the money to carry that forward, or I think they would have. So it was after some exploration license to a European firm who built a semi-works, and I continue to think we'll at the right time build a world-scale plant on it. It offers somewhere between a 20% and 30% cost advantage for methacrylates over the time-honored cyanhydrin process, and more important, you don't have to work with HCN to make it. You can, anybody who has a refinery can have an MMA plant, and on an equal plant size basis, if you talk about a billion-pound plant, a lot of people have seen billion-pound styrene plants. Nobody's ever seen more than a 300-million-pound pound-a-year MMA plant line. But at equal plant size, which with the propylene CO process is possible, MMA could be priced to the market probably 20% to 30% lower than styrene. Styrene derives from benzene at 25 cents a pound and ethylene at 10 to 12, and propylene and CO are roughly 14 to 15 and 6 to 8 cents a pound respectively, and I think the world could do a lot with MMA that doesn't do any of those prices. We also developed the world's first engineering rim resin, which found its first use in 1986 General Motors automobiles, and a new type of thermoplastic, or a new type of composite matrix resin with a coefficient of linear thermal expansion 5 times lower than epoxies, which are now used. And that's, as far as I know now, being advanced into aircraft uses with some major manufacturing firms. And there were some other things, but that's, that was sort of where things were at Ashland when I left there. And so being offered the 10-carat parachute, I took it, and here I am at Rutgers.
Just a brief word, I think, about the... I was not aware that there was a packaging engineering department.
Yeah.
So maybe a brief word about this department and its origin and your role here.
Well, to put it in perspective, the oldest and largest packaging school in the United States is at Michigan State, which is larger than all the rest of them combined, and they have a very fine school. There are also fine schools at RIT and Clemson, Cal Poly, Wisconsin, one in Indiana at, can't think of the name at the minute, 14 around the country. The Rutgers program, which is the second oldest and third largest, originated here in 1965 in the food science department, and as the science of materials began to become more important in packaging, why it moved to the engineering college, where it was recognized by my predecessor that the design and production of packages is really an engineering function. And if you look at the fact that half of thermoplastics are used in packaging, and that some very significant portion, I keep trying to arrive at the proper number of the gross national product, is packaging related. Packaging is a very pervasive and important subject. Two things that I like to make note of is that there is a direct correlation. Chemists used to correlate the level of a civilization by how much sulfuric acid they consumed. There's also a direct correlation between life quality in the countries and regions of the world and the amount and sophistication level of the packaging they use. And the second verbal gem is one I think of my own coining. Modern packages are engineered products made from engineered materials. Paper, glass, metals, plastics are all very engineered materials, and the forming of the package is an engineering process. So yes, packaging engineering, I think, is emerging as an engineering field in the same way that aeronautical engineering emerged from the marriage of civil and mechanical engineering 50 years ago, and chemical engineering emerged from chemistry and mechanical engineering with a little electrical thrown in 100 years ago. And right now, like all universities, why Rutgers is struggling with its budgets and how to survive, and the question is whether the small packaging tiger will get eaten by the larger tigers in the cage. But so far, why the program is surviving and expanding. Very challenging.
What I'd like to do now is turn to this list, which
yeah.
I think you saw.
Yes. We've
covered a number of things on this list, but let me just pull in a few more questions here, if I may. What does scientific innovation mean to you from your experience? There are many different ways of defining it, and I'm looking at...
Yeah. I didn't have a chance to do much homework on that list before this meeting because of the short time. I guess I'd like to think up a better answer than I'm just likely to give off the top of my head and phone it down to you. Let's arrange for a phone call a week later or something.
All right.
I think innovation has a even though patents are granted only on the basis of novelty and utility, I think innovation, to me, connotes, in many, if not most cases, a unique combination of disciplines, rubbing two technology or science areas together that result in the development or the origin of a concept or a material or a technique that didn't exist previously. And also, innovation also, to me, has, again, a utilitarian or an economic baseline in it that says an innovation must in some way be useful, not just novel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Every time I ask this question, I get it's a different twist of every, because it's based on experience, and everyone's experience is different. So I'm intrigued by the difference.
Am I in the mainstream?
Oh yes, no, it's, yeah. it all fits very nicely. But there's no two that are alike, which is quite interesting.
I think one thing I'd add about innovation is innovation can have analogies in them that result from historic origins. I think sometimes you are led to innovation by looking backwards and then looking ahead. And so I'm a great advocate of the study of science history.
Shoulders of giants, you said
shoulders
earlier.
Shoulders of giants, if you will. Trying to learn from how other people have combined different areas.
Scientific teamwork. You cited a number of people that you were, mm-hmm. and what's your experience with scientific teamwork?
Well, I think first of all you have to look at it in two categories. The shoulders of giants concept, I think, is one of the most valid ones that I've heard put forth in my lifetime. You don't do anything in science but that you build on what others have done before you, however you want to put it, shoulders of giants or whatever. And in that connection, I think that drawing on that background and the knowledge that others have built before you, you have to give proper credit to generation of concepts or ideas which one is apt to feel are totally original, which in fact rarely ever are. But that process, I think, given that it occurs that way, usually occurs in one brain rather than many simultaneously. I think the idea of six men sitting around a table all jumping up Eureka at the same time is a fairy tale.
Okay.
On the other hand, once a concept or invention has been made, it's the laws of probability of its ever being put forward without a team effort are infinitesimal. Simply because teams are by nature multidisciplinary, and that's how things get from the laboratory to the marketplace. That's as simply as I can put it.
That's great. What did you do in terms of contacts outside the company, peer relationships, but in other areas, other companies? Did you have that much of that, or were you isolated?
No, I was encouraged to do it, and I had a lot of them. A lot of them came through professional society work. The record, of course, shows that I was pretty active in the American Chemical Society and to some lesser extent in a number of others. The Industrial Research Institute, which I was not active at all in, it's Ohio because the representation was held by other members, but I became very active in it in Ashland and worked on many of their committees. And I've always done a lot of networking, but not exactly through societies. A lot of times just by reading of journals or articles and contacting people and establishing acquaintances. I've been lucky to be in organizations that encourage that. Some don't, I think.
Right, exactly. That's why I was asking the question.
Yeah, exactly.
Changes in company R&D support during your career. The support, the attitude of the senior management towards R&D, did you see? What kind of changes did you see over your career?
Well, I think in my experiences at Sohio, it was nearly always positive. In a couple of times at Sohio, we went through the usual assessment processes by outside agencies, and these caused a predictable and understandable amount of shock and nervousness, but with the exception of one such experience or one such occurrence, I think the company dealt pretty wisely with their professional staff. There was one occasion when I think that they employed the wrong organization and it was the wrong time to do it. But companies have to guard against deadwood. It's a fact of life. And deadwood, after a time, becomes ironwood, which becomes an anchor. I think also that in my experience in both Sohio and Ashland, that the management attitude was very largely positive. It underwent some stressful times when, because of economic circumstances, the company had to decide what operations to curtail, and usually research and advertising are the two that go first. And I think those two companies were just following the pattern. I am concerned, as a lot of people are, about the downsizing trend in virtually, it's virtually sweeping across industry. And I'm also concerned about, now that I can speak safely from the whatever security there is in an academic chair, I think that in many cases it's going to prove to be penny wise and pound foolish, particularly in technology-based corporations where survival, much less a highly profitable operation, depends on advantageous technology. One is eating the seed corn to cut off all but short-range fix-it type research. The concept that some companies seem to have taken, that we don't need to develop our own technology, whatever is needed we can go out and buy it, turns out to be a big misconception. Purchase technology is just like an automobile. The minute you drive it out of the showroom, it starts to depreciate. And if you're not prepared to support it, maintain it, and develop new generations, you'd better not buy it in the first place.
Well, you've just answered my next question, which is great. But you, at lunch today, you had, I wanted you to repeat the analogy you gave me of the 50s through the 90s.
Oh.
I really enjoyed that.
Well, I can't remember just when this was. I believe it was in the early 80s. I was asked to give a members and fellows lecture for the American Institute of Chemists. And in it, I was... can't remember, either asked or decided to address the economic trend across the chemical and the chemical related industries in the time frames that I had seen them, and make some projections. And I did this. There's a copy of that paper somewhere, but I don't know where it is, probably in Ohio. But I remember using the expressions the fabulous 50s, the soaring 60s, the sobering 70s, the awesome 80s, and the 90s, several terms that we haven't quite selected yet, but it would not be a very positive outlooking term. And yet, one must be cautious never to abandon optimism and see the bright side of things. One door seldom closes, but another opens.
I have one last question on my list, and that is, what did it mean to you to win the Perkin Medal?
Well, it was a great surprise. One always hopes for something like that, but when I opened the letter and found out what it read, at first it was a little bit unbelievable, and then I thought, well, I'd better make sure this is really what I think it is and not just a mistake or a misreading on my part. So I timidly lifted the phone and put in a call to Ed Jefferson, never dreaming that he would answer the telephone at his own house. And I said, "Dr. Jefferson, is this true?" And he said, "Who's this?" And I said, "Well, it's Jim Idle." And he said, "Oh, yes, congratulations." So Ed and I became, if not close friends, rather good friends that instant.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point that we
not that covered? I can think of. I believe you've downloaded me very effectively. If I think of anything, I'll be sure to pass it along.
All right. If you find a copy of this talk, because
yes,
you mentioned this, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I'll sure look for that.
And I'd like to thank you for spending the afternoon with me. It was delightful. I've enjoyed it, and it's very good information here.
It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
I think another factor that I hope in some cases I've managed to remember, but that in other cases I humbly suggest might be a guideline for developing chemical technology or new technology of any kind. One question that ought to be answered or addressed is, does it help people, or where might it be used? And is there any possibility that it might harm people? And if so, is the cost-benefit ratio justifiable?